Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Compliance Week News Podcast. I'm Joe Mott, staff writer at Compliance Week. The Environmental Protection Agency is cracking down on fraud in the marketplace for renewable energy credits, putting the nation's fuel refiners on notice and underscoring the need for them to exercise greater due diligence. The Renewable Energy Credit Program, begun in 2009, is a response to government mandates that fuel producers blend a prescribed amount of biofuels, including ethanol, into their products. Producers receive a renewable fuel credit, a certificate bearing a renewable identification number, for every gallon of biofuel they create using animal fat or vegetable oil. These credits can be sold to refiners to help them offset the biodiesel mandate. For more than a year, the EPA has aggressively investigated and prosecuted fraud in the marketplace, and that includes counterfeit renewable identification numbers and sham companies selling shares of non-existent biofuel to willing buyers. It isn't just fraudsters who should be concerned. Companies that buy bogus credits are also on the hook and face both fines and a requirement to purchase legitimate credits. In December, for example, the EPA uncovered 33.5 million fake renewable fuel credits sold by an Indiana company. It was the fourth major action in this arena, with previous ones reclaiming nearly 140 million fake credits. In this week's podcast, we talked to EPA Attorney Jeff Kodish and Doug Parker, director of the EPA's Criminal Investigation Division, about the program, the fraud, the due diligence expected of buyers, and what they can do to protect themselves. We asked Kodish to provide some background about renewable energy credits and how the biofuel program works.
They can use these credits, or RINs, that represent renewable fuel used by other parties. So just quickly to illustrate how the credit trading program works, if we assumed that the volume standard for the whole country was 10% of all the gasoline and diesel fuel used in the country, each obligated party would have to either assure that they produced or used 10% of the total fuel that they made as renewable fuel, or they could buy RINs representing 10% of that fuel. So when this program is fully implemented, the agency expects that it will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 138 million tons per year, which is the equivalent of the emissions from about 27 million vehicles.
Parker describes the nature of the fraud.
On the criminal end, what we saw first were just pockets. We saw information leads that developed, which were really kind of traditional inquiries to law enforcement agencies about excessive spending and individuals who were buying fast cars and big houses. And at first blush, we thought it was part of sort of a drug trade. But we dug a little deeper, and we found in a couple of instances, these were essentially sham companies who popped up who had gotten into the trading business of renewable fuel credits for generating essentially no renewable fuel. And so we pursued those as traditional criminal cases, traditional criminal fraud cases with our law enforcement partners. But what we realized was the problem was more significant. And we looked at ways to identify where the fraud was occurring before, you know, tens of millions of dollars had been defrauded and the system had been weakened. And we worked with our civil enforcement counterparts to look at patterns and trends, and we really analyzed the data, and we looked and we found a number of conflicting data sources, which for us were indicators that fraud was occurring within certain companies. And we pursued those companies aggressively using, again, expertise from our civil enforcement colleagues, and we've opened a number of cases around the country. Thus far, there have been two convictions, and two large-scale frauds have been charged, have yet to go to trial, and additional cases are underway.
Were buyers unaware that they were stepping into such scenarios and doing business with sham companies? Parker explains.
Well, in the initial phases, you know, there was a, you know, this was a young but vibrant market where credits were traded multiple times. And at times, the tracking of those credits by the end users, the obligated parties, were challenging. You know, these were transactions that were occurring on a daily basis. So in some instances, identifying the origin of those credits was challenging. But in other instances, there was a lack of due diligence on the obligated parties. Some of the entities involved in this at the very outset who were defrauding the obligated parties were, you know, didn't have even a vat to, boil a pot of renewable fuel. I mean, they were, you know, nothing. And so basic due diligence was lacking at the very outset. I think that's changed dramatically, and I think the enforcement efforts, both the civil and criminal enforcement efforts, have led to much greater due diligence, follow-up, third-party verification. And so the landscape, I think, is dramatically different than it was 3-4 years ago. But the areas that we're focusing on now are really moving beyond the sham producers, which really I think have been driven out of the market, to more complex frauds where there is actually production going on, but the production may be significantly less than the numbers of credits that they're producing. So as the program's gotten more sophisticated and the due diligence has increased, in some cases the fraud schemes have gotten more complex, and we're ratcheting our efforts up to address those.
Parker describes how the fraud not only undermines the congressional intent of the program, it also hurts companies that participated in it legitimately.
The majority of the actors out there in this market are operating within the scope of the rules and the regulations. And really our job in this case is to preserve the integrity of the market and the integrity of those folks who are playing by the rules, the overwhelming majority of the participants. So, and I think our efforts jointly on the civil and criminal enforcement side have really helped stabilize that. I think the combination of our efforts, the enhanced due diligence that obligated parties are engaged in, as well as some anticipated regulatory changes, are really strengthening the market from where it was 3-4 years ago.
Kodish elaborated on the repercussions for buyers.
Well, the RFS program is set up as a buyer beware program, and essentially what that means is that it's up to the obligated parties to make sure that the RINs or the credits that they're buying represent real qualifying renewable fuel. And it's a violation of the RFS regulations for these obligated parties to use invalid RINs to meet their renewable volume standard obligations. As a result of this, what we have done on the civil side is we've notified the obligated parties that use those RINs that were invalid that they're required to remove them from their compliance accounts and assure that they've got sufficient valid RINs to meet the renewable fuel mandate. Now, we also implemented a streamlined program to try to do this in an efficient way that would bring some stability to the market and be fair to all the parties. And this streamlined process basically had two components. We sent the obligated parties a settlement offer, and that settlement offer required them to remove the invalid RINs and replace them with valid RINs, and then it also required them to pay a relatively small penalty. Virtually all of the obligated parties who use these invalid credits have replaced them and entered into agreements with us.
These cases show that buyers must exert greater due diligence. How should they vet and verify? How can they make sure they are not buying or using fraudulent credits? What should they look out for in order to protect themselves? Kodish details some of these expectations.
I would echo what Jeff said, and that we can't prescribe specific steps or approaches. But I think it's worth industry in some cases taking a cue from how we addressed and found this fraud. As I said, the initial cases occurred, and we were notified after significant fraud had occurred. And we looked at opportunities for us to analyze data. There's a tremendous amount of data and data points and engineering information that this industry, like other industries, are engaged in. And we began to look at the conflicting data points, which were really glaringly suggestive of fraud in certain instances. For example, engineering reports that a company was required to produce, was required to file with the agency, were compared with the volume that they were producing. And in some cases, you had a facility that could, from an engineering standpoint, could produce very little, or in the early stages, may not have had a certification, And that was then compared with the credits they were trading. And they were wildly inconsistent. And so that's not a surefire method, and it's just one example. But looking from a due diligence perspective at the different data and the different data points that these entities are required to produce can be certainly a foot in the door to find out in terms of their legitimacy. I mean, one thing that we have seen that's been unfortunate in this is that when the enforcement ramped up, very legitimate smaller producers were being ignored by the larger obligated parties because they didn't want the kind of the hassle. But there were very good, high-quality smaller producers that had the data to show that they were effectively able to sell this, and they were hurt in the whole process because people began to ignore them. But really going back to that data and the analysis on the due diligence side is critical for the obligated parties.
Parker adds his perspective.
Sure, there's a wide variety of business relationships and circumstances associated with these RIN transactions. So it's really not practical for the agency to prescribe kind of precise ways in which all the parties should conduct due diligence. But the core concept here is kind of similar to the way a company would vet a vendor. One part of the program, though, that requires special attention is that in order to determine if a fuel qualifies, the company has to look at the feedstock and the processes that were used to produce the fuel, as well as the quality of the fuel, since all of those issues can impact the validity of the credits or the RINs. In order to kind of make this process of vetting easier, the EPA has proposed to establish a new third-party voluntary quality assurance program for verifying the RINs. This voluntary program would rely on independent third-party auditors who would look at the types of feedstocks, the volumes of fuel, the process that the parties are using, and kind of create a structured, more efficient way to assure that the RINs entering commerce are valid. We expect that this program is really going to kind of promote greater liquidity in the market and help out some of the small producers who are having a hard time selling their RINs after the enforcement actions kind of cause people to start conducting more due diligence.
That's all for this week's podcast. I'm Joe Mott, staff writer at Compliance Week. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.